Well, we saw last time then that Jephthah is a bit different from the other judges whom we've encountered so far in our series in this book. Jephthah, you remember, isn't appointed by Yahweh. And we saw that the reason for that is that Yahweh is so grieved by Israel's latest bout of idolatry that he has walked out on the relationship with Israel. Israel has crossed a line this time and has forfeited the privilege of Yahweh raising up for them another judge to bail them out. And so Yahweh is done with Israel. How is Jephthah appointed then? Well, through a purely human process. You remember how he's recruited by the leaders of Gilead. They go and send for him, and they entreat him to become their deliverer, the one who will lead them into battle with the Ammonites. And so Jephthah, as I say, is a bit different in this very important sense. But remember, we also saw last time that as the story of Jephthah proceeds, the plot thickens. Such is Yahweh's character that he almost cannot bring himself to go through with this divorce with Israel. And so you remember how he suddenly returns to his people. All seems to be over. All seems to be lost. Yahweh seems to have walked out forever, but he suddenly returns to his people. And in a remarkable piece of condescension, he actually uses as his deliverer this man who has been appointed in completely the wrong way, in this completely anomalous, irregular, illegitimate way. Yahweh takes that man in his hand, Jephthah, and uses him as his own deliverer. Then we read tonight then the point at which that happens, where the fake, unauthorized judge suddenly becomes the real thing. And like his predecessors then, is empowered by the Spirit of the Lord, verse 29. And like his predecessors now, has the enemy divinely given into his hand, verse 32. And that's quite a story then in itself. And if that were the end of the whole matter, as readers, we would probably be satisfied with that. There are plenty of twists and turns there. This man who seems to be a completely fake judge, an imitation judge, but then Yahweh comes and uses him anyway, and he becomes in that way an official judge. It's quite a story in itself, but there's more, isn't there? And it's as this transformation takes place in Jephthah, it's as he becomes at last a recognizable judge figure, like Othniel and Ehud and Gideon and all the rest of them, it's at that point in the narrative that he, of course, does the thing that he's most famous for. Verse 30, Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, "If you will give the Ammonites into my hand, then whatever comes out from the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the Ammonites shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering." And it's this then, it's Jephthah's vow that we're going to focus on this evening, not at the expense of verses 12 to 28, which seem on the face of things unrelated to the vow. We'll be referring aplenty to those verses too. But chiefly tonight, we're going to try to get to the bottom of this strange vow that Jephthah makes. And let me just say then, before we go any further, I believe that Jephthah intended all along to sacrifice a human being. Jephthah, I believe, intended all along to sacrifice a human being. "Whatever comes out from the doors of my house to meet me." Now, you'll see in the ESV that it can be whatever or whoever. Now, that doesn't decide the matter because it, in the Hebrew it could be either. But it's pretty clear, isn't it, from the language he uses, that he's not envisaging here a sheep or a goat or something that's going to come out to meet him. I mean, for one thing, what is a sheep or a goat doing in his house anyway while he's away at war? And for another thing, this is clearly an intelligent response by someone to the fact that he's coming home from the battlefield. It's like Sisera's mother, you remember back in Deborah and Barak's song. and the way in which her son, Sisera, is engaged in battle with the Israelites, of course. And there she is, and she's at home, and she's looking through the lattice, and she's waiting for him, and waiting for him, and waiting for him. And of course, in that case, he never comes home, and we know why she doesn't. And that's surely what Jephthah is envisaging here. He's envisaging someone looking out for him, waiting for the homecoming of this leader of the people on the battlefields. And it's such a one that he envisages coming out to him. Now, he probably didn't think that it would be his daughter, or at least he was willing to gamble on it not being his daughter who would come out. Hence his grief when it is his daughter and he tears his clothes. Presumably he envisaged a servant or one of those rogues that he'd surrounded himself with at the start of the narrative. It was presumably someone like that that he envisaged coming out. But it seems to me the fact he intended the sacrifice to be a human being is inescapable. The language just doesn't fit any other situation. He intends here to sacrifice a human being. And so, having established that, I want to say three things about this vow. First of all, it's traceable. It's traceable. Because, of course, the question that all of what I've just said raises, more than any other question, is this: how could an Israelite make a vow to sacrifice a human being? I mean, how is that feasible, that an Israelite would make such a vow? Well, I think that the text itself indicates how Jephthah got to that point. There's a crucial verse, and it comes then within this lengthy speech that he delivers through messengers to the king of the Ammonites. Now, we'll talk a bit more about that speech later. But you probably grasp then, as we read the passage this evening, that the Ammonites' intimidation of Israel was more sophisticated than that of the other nations who have intimidated Israel so far in this book. The others just dealt in raw military aggression, basically. And certainly the Ammonites are not lacking in that department. We saw last time the strong words that the narrator uses back in chapter 10, verse 8, to describe the brutality of the Ammonites' oppression. But unlike the other nations who have oppressed Israel so far in this book, the Ammonites don't see themselves merely as invaders taking advantage of Israel's smallness and weakness. No, they see themselves as the rightful claimants to Israel's land. Or some of it at least, that part of it that is east of the River Jordan. And they have their version then of history to support this claim that they make on that part of Israel's land. And that then is the reason for this long speech that Jephthah makes through his messengers. He's engaging with and countering this claim that the Ammonites are making to the land. And it's a fine speech then, as we shall see. But it has one jarring note in it. And that jarring note, you may have picked it up as we read the passage, it comes in verse 24. In verses 21 to 23, Jephthah has made the point that Yahweh gave Israel this piece of land that's in dispute, this piece of land east of the Jordan. It was given to them by Yahweh. And that, of course, is a good point that Jephthah makes there. But then he continues in verse 24, "Will you not possess what Chemosh, your God, gives you to possess? And all that the Lord our God has dispossessed before us, we will possess." And so he's saying then, you know, you've received land from your God. And you know what it's like then to receive land from your God and to feel you're the rightful occupants of the land you've been given by your God. Well, it's the same for us Israelites. We've been given land by our God. And we feel, therefore, that we are the rightful occupants of it. And you see then how different Jephthah's tone is from the tone of Psalm 115 that we sang earlier on in our service tonight. That psalm that is so devastating in its critique of the gods of the nations. They are the work of human hands. They don't speak, they don't see, they don't hear, they don't smell, they don't feel, they don't walk. In other words, they're as dead as dodos. That's what the psalmist is saying about the gods of the other nations. Now, certainly Jephthah, he seems to regard Chemosh as inferior to Yahweh. We can grant to him that. Yahweh, he says in verse 27, is the judge in some sense that enables him to arbitrate in a way that Chemosh can't ultimately do so. So yes, he sees Yahweh as higher and greater and superior, but for Jephthah, the difference between Yahweh and Chemosh is simply one of degree. It's not that one of these is God and the other is an abominable lie. No, they're both gods in Jephthah's mind. It's just that one is more powerful and authoritative than the other. And you see the significance of that then for what we're looking at this evening. You see, if, like the author of Psalm 115, you regard the other gods as abominable lies, then you are not going to look twice at the worship practices associated with those other gods. You're not going to see any relevance in those worship practices for you. If, on the other hand, you regard the other gods as genuine, albeit inferior, then there's no compelling reason why their worship practices can't be adapted to your worship of the better God, including then this worship practice. Expressing your extravagant devotion to God by sacrificing another human being. Jephthah would have observed that happening in the surrounding nations. It was common. We see that in many other passages of the Old Testament where the other nations are roundly condemned by Israel's prophets precisely on this ground, that they sacrifice human beings, they sacrifice their own children even. And the other gods then, the other gods who in Jephthah's mind are real, they appreciated this sort of thing. They appreciated these extravagant gestures of devotion to them. Why shouldn't Yahweh? And so I'm saying then that this vow that Jephthah makes here, which just taken in isolation just seems so incredible, coming from an Israelite, it's traceable. You can trace it back to this attitude he betrays in verse 24, this attitude to the other gods. And that, of course, raises the question, well, why does Jephthah have that attitude to the other gods? Why doesn't he have the same attitude as the author of Psalm 115? Well, I don't know the answer to that question, but it's interesting in that connection, isn't it, that Jephthah's knowledge of Yahweh's redemptive acts is second to none. I mean, he has a wonderfully extensive knowledge, doesn't he, of redemption, of what God has done for his people. The way he can, in that speech to the king of the Ammonites, the way he can work through the history, he has a wonderful knowledge of Yahweh's redemptive acts, yet presumably he doesn't have a great knowledge, if any knowledge at all, of Yahweh's law. I mean, he couldn't possibly have done this if he was remotely knowledgeable about Yahweh's law. And I think there's a disconnect there in Jephthah between knowing so well the redemptive acts of God and being so unfamiliar with the law of God that perhaps is salutary and that's is worth just reflecting on for all of us. I think in perhaps in many Christian conservative evangelical circles today, there's a great emphasis on the gospel. Everything's gospel-driven, everything's gospel-centered. And yet perhaps a de-emphasis on Christian duty and obedience. Those aren't words that we hear quite so often. And there's this idea perhaps that the gospel just kind of automatically produces holy Christians. Exposure to the gospel just automatically produces holy Christians without the need for a great emphasis on duties and responsibilities and obedience. And I have some sympathy with that. I mean, there is a sense, isn't there, in which all our ethics must be rooted in the gospel. Otherwise, it's just legalism. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all. It's as we're exposed to the gospel of God's grace that the desire to obey God and be like Jesus is engendered within us. But at the same time, we need to know, don't we, precisely what giving my soul and my life and my all for God looks like. Does it look like sacrificing my children on an altar somewhere? We won't know that actually it means paying our taxes properly to the government. And it means not letting the sun go down on our anger. And it means praying for those who persecute us and a whole load of other things like that. We won't know that unless we emphasize duties and responsibilities and the ethical sections of the Bible. So there's a disconnect, I think, in Jephthah here, between gospel and law, which we must be careful about, even in our own situation. So that disconnect perhaps explains then why Jephthah is so woolly regarding the other gods. But let me just return to this point before moving on, that woolliness then regarding a theological truth is what I think led Jephthah ultimately to do what he infamously does. And isn't that a powerful reminder to us that ideas have consequences? Theological ideas have consequences. Because again, we live in a context, don't we, where even in Christian circles you hear so much, well, it doesn't matter so much what we believe. Doctrine, theology, these things don't matter greatly. Ask Jephthah's daughter whether it matters what we believe. Because I'm saying that what Jephthah does to his daughter here, you can trace back to his theology, his thinking. He sees the other gods as being real. And seeing the other gods as being real, he sees their worship practices as being transferable and adaptable. And so he does what he does. Ideas have consequences. A theological idea surfaces that those who never have the opportunity to encounter the gospel, but who are zealous about their own religious expressions, that they'll be accepted by God at the end of the day. And initially then, that theological idea coexists with the need still to preach the gospel as much as we can and to as many people as we can. But then over time, that shift, that movement, it has an effect. And the urgency about gospel proclamation lessens and diminishes until we get to a point where taking the gospel to other nations is arrogant and colonial and all the rest of it. I'm just giving that as another example of how an idea can have such far-reaching consequences in the way that we see with Jephthah here. So that's the first thing then to notice. It's traceable, this vow. You can trace it back to his thinking as expressed in verse 24. Secondly, it's verbal, this vow. It's traceable, it's verbal. Now that may seem like an exercise in stating the obvious. What else could it be if not verbal? But it is interesting, isn't it, that Jephthah's worst moment then involves words. It involves speaking. And that's interesting because Jephthah's best moments also involve words and speaking. So that passage we looked at last time at the beginning of chapter 11, where the leaders of Gilead approach Jephthah, wanting him to be their leader in this battle with the Ammonites. And we haven't got time to go back into this now, but remember we saw last time that the way he speaks to those leaders, the way he negotiates with them, he seems to me at least to be kind of representing, picturing, modeling Yahweh himself to them. And Israel has rejected Yahweh and now wants Yahweh in its time of need. And in the same way, these Gileadites have rejected Jephthah and now are going to him in their time of need. And Jephthah seems to understand that parallel and to play on that parallel. And it's again a brilliant piece of rhetoric, of speech, there at the beginning of chapter 11. And then, of course, supremely, there's this long speech we've already touched on to the king of the Ammonites. And again, it's really fine speech that he engages in. It has that jarring note, that very significant jarring note that we've talked about. But nonetheless, it's a brilliant speech. It's brilliant for various reasons. Brilliant for its knowledge. We've mentioned this already. Just the way in which Jephthah has such an awareness, such a grasp of Israel's history and all Israel's movements, having departed Egypt from there to entering the promised land. It's brilliant for its knowledge. Then again, it's brilliant for its clarity. We, again, have mentioned already tonight that he emphasizes in verses 21 to 23 that this part of the land that the Ammonites are now claiming, it was a gift to Israel from Yahweh. Now that could sound fishy, that could just sound very convenient, couldn't it? Oh well, yeah, it's easy for you to say, really, you just stormed in and claimed that land for yourselves, you Israelites. Well, Jephthah is very clear that charge cannot possibly be made, because he stresses, doesn't he, in the verses before that, verses 17 and down, verse 17 and 18 really, he stresses that the Israelites have been very respectful of the Edomites and the Moabites on this same journey between Egypt and Canaan. If they were the aggressive sort who were just into grabbing land for themselves, they'd have done that to Edom and Moab, but they didn't. They were provoked. They were rebutted by the Edomites and the Moabites. So what did they do? They skirted round so respectfully, so civilly, so politely. And so in that way, Jephthah makes it very clear that when they did eventually take land from Sihon, it was because it was a gift from Yahweh, not because they were being aggressive. So it's brilliant for its knowledge, its clarity, it's brilliant for its precision. Because do you notice how he stresses in verses 21 to 23 that actually it was the Amorites who possessed this land before them anyway? It wasn't the Ammonites. Verse 21, Israel took possession of all the land of the Amorites. Verse 22, they took possession of all the territory of the Amorites. Verse 23, the Lord dispossessed the Amorites. It wasn't yours anyway. So not only did Yahweh give it to us as a gift, but the land he gave to us as a gift wasn't your land to start with. That's what he's saying there. He's very precise as to who was living there before they took the land. And it's brilliant then, fourthly, for its logic. Verse 26. An answerable logic there. While Israel lived in Heshbon and its villages and in Aroer and its villages and in all the cities that are on the banks of the Arnon 300 years, why did you not deliver them within that time? In other words, if you had a genuine grievance, surely you'd have done something about it before 300 years went by. This is just opportunism on your part, you Ammonites. That's what Jephthah is saying there. And then for another thing, it's brilliant for its boldness. Verse 27. This is just Jephthah, who's a virtual nobody, And he's speaking here to a king, the king of the Ammonites. He's so wonderfully bold, isn't he? I have not sinned against you. You do me wrong by making war on me. So the point I'm making then is that Jephthah's speech until now has been his greatest asset in the service of God. And yet it's now how he commits his greatest folly. That's different from Samson, isn't it? Samson, those of you who have heard me preach on Samson before may remember, Samson commits his greatest folly, his greatest follies, through his eyes continually leading him astray. That's his point of weakness. And it's simple. It's simple as that. His eyes keep leading him into trouble. He keeps seeing women especially and being led into trouble. His eyes are his point of weakness. Simple as that. With Jephthah, things are more complex. It's this thing by which he has served God so effectively. His speech. It's that strength. It's that asset that becomes his point of weakness. Should that not make us all very humble and vigilant? That thing that we have brought God glory by, that facility, that gift, that strength that we have used often to bring God glory and to serve his kingdom, there's nothing that guarantees it will always be used in that way. I mean, you might be a very logical person, able to dismantle arguments and have used that greatly for God's glory. You may be a very sensitive person in whom others naturally confide, and you may have used that fruitfully for the glory of God, but these assets can turn bad. That's what I'm saying. Jephthah's asset turns bad. He's a man of eloquence, and now he uses that eloquence to speak this extravagant vow to Yahweh, which is just riddled with folly. And it's why we need to constantly pray the hymn that we sang just a few moments ago. Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee, now and in the future, as it has been in the past, because there's no guarantee that it always will be. Jephthah needed to pray, take my voice and let me sing always only for my king. Take my lips and let them be filled with messages from thee. They had been filled with messages from God, and he had used his lips effectively for God, and now his lips have become his point of weakness. And we need to pray constantly that the Spirit will fill even those parts of us that are our strengths, and that we might think will always naturally be our strengths. We need to pray that they will continue to be Spirit-filled and used of God and won't turn bad like Jephthah's speaking. So this vow then, it's traceable, it's verbal. One final thing, it's comparable. It's comparable. Now, in one sense, of course, it's pretty much incomparable. It's pretty unique within the scriptures. Not that we don't have other vows, but we don't have any other vows like this one, that's for sure. But when I say then that this moment in the Jephthah narrative is comparable, I'm thinking of Gideon, actually, one of Jephthah's predecessors, of course, whom we've already considered in this series in Judges. And it seems to me that there's a point of comparison here with Gideon. Now, I'm not thinking of vows or of the fleece business with Gideon. I'm thinking rather of the way in which, at the end of the Gideon narrative, he, you remember, attacks his own people. Two cities, Succoth and Penuel. And they are Israelite cities. And Gideon, like all the other judges, has been, of course, appointed by God to attack enemy oppressors, nations from outside who are oppressing Israel, and Gideon does that, but he then also goes on to attack his own people. In other words, if you're an Israelite under Gideon, you're not necessarily safe. If you're a Midianite at the time of Gideon, you're not safe, and that's how it should be. But even if you're an Israelite under Gideon's leadership, you're not necessarily safe. Not if you're a citizen of Succoth or Penuel, you're not. And here then it's that unsafeness that is taken, of course, a step further, isn't it? Because with Jephthah, it's not simply that you're not necessarily safe as an Israelite, you're not necessarily safe even if you're in his own family, his own household, even if you're his own daughter, you're not necessarily safe. Gideon attacked Israelites precisely because he was actually concerned about the interests of his own family. He was avenging his brothers. Here we have a Jephthah, and he's not simply attacking Israelites, he ends up attacking his own family, his own daughter. It's a theme actually that we get elsewhere in the Old Testament. I preached, I can't remember when it was, a year or two ago, a one-off sermon entitled, Are You Safe in David's Hands? Contrasting Mephibosheth, who was safe under David, with Uriah the Hittite, who wasn't safe under David, his own king. His wife taken, his life taken by his own king, the one who should have been protecting him. And we have that then in Judges with Gideon. And now more conspicuously with Jephthah. And surely then we can't contemplate this theme without stepping back and remembering what these judges are all about in terms of the biblical storyline. And we've said several times, they are pointing us to Jesus, aren't they? The one who ultimately will be raised up by God to deliver his people from their enemies. But of course, while at times they point us to Jesus in a wonderful way, by actually showing us in preview form just what Jesus will be like, at other times they kind of highlight Jesus by contrast, don't they? And it's their weaknesses and their failures that remind us, hang on a minute, Samson's not the real saviour that we're looking forward to. Gideon's not. Jephthah's not. Jesus is better. And Jesus is better than Jephthah. Better in lots of ways, of course. And just as an aside, it's striking, isn't it, in the poignant final part of this narrative, how lacking in compassion Jephthah is for his daughter. He seems completely self-absorbed. He says to her there in verse 35, Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low. You have become the cause of great trouble to me. Hang on a minute. What about her? And yet Jephthah just seems unaware of her misery. But she's his only child, and he's going to become childless. And that seems to be what is upsetting Jephthah. And I think the narrator highlights his lack of sympathy and compassion by kind of contrasting him with these others who do mourn for Jephthah's daughter. The companions who go out onto the mountains with her in verse 38 and mourn for two whole months with her. And then not only they who have good reason to, because they are her friends, but then in verse 40 we're told that people for years after went and did this and remembered Jephthah's daughter. So complete strangers generations later felt deeply for Jephthah's daughter. Jephthah doesn't seem to feel all that deeply for his daughter. He's too self-absorbed. And that, of course, is such a contrast, isn't it, with the true judge, the true rescuer, Jesus Christ, who is the opposite of self-absorbed, who constantly, throughout that mission on earth, puts the interests of others above his own, the interests of us, and is willing to sacrifice all his safety, all his comfort, for our sakes, for our salvation. But it's really this point of Jephthah as an unsafe judge that I want to close on. Like Gideon, like David at one point at least, Jephthah, you're not safe in Jephthah's hands. And more than that, it's interesting, isn't it, that particularly it's Jephthah's words to the Lord that imperil his daughter. There's a stress on that. Verse 35, he says, I have opened my mouth to the Lord. And then she says, doesn't she, in the next verse, my father, you have opened your mouth to the Lord. So it's the words that Jephthah speaks to the Lord that here have imperiled his daughter, this one he should have been protecting. And again, what a contrast we have in Jesus, don't we? Jesus will never, ever speak words to the Lord, to his Father, that imperil his people. In fact, the New Testament stresses the opposite, doesn't it? That what is Jesus doing now, in this stage of his ministry on our behalf? He's speaking words to the Lord. He's interceding. Words that will never imperil us, but on the contrary, bless us. Words of prayer, help this disciple of mine in Newcastle who's struggling. Words of defense as Satan throws charges and accusations. I've paid for that sin that Satan is charging this disciple of mine of doing. Jesus is speaking to the Lord constantly now. Words that bless us and words that strengthen us and words that do us good. Never do we need to lie awake at night worrying that our judge, that our King Jesus, might be saying something to the Lord that will plunge us into disaster. And so let's rejoice in our greater than Jephthah. There are points of comparison. Jesus, the Spirit anointed him. Jesus destroyed the enemy at Calvary like Jephthah destroyed the Ammonites. But in so many ways, Jesus is vastly better. And particularly in this, you and I are safe under King Jesus. Amen.